Hi, this is Keith Kefchin, and you're listening to Dollars and Drivers, a podcast that allows leaders an outlet to discuss what drives them and their distinct way of succeeding in life and business. Today, I had the great pleasure of speaking with a former client and now good friend, Dave Garrison, who's the author of The Buy-In Advantage, a really great book and really simple but effective ways of leading organizations, strategic planning sessions, and the like. Hope you enjoy.
How's life? What are you celebrating? What's going on?
Just celebrating a nice long career. I gotta say, it creeps up on me, but things are good. Business has been, kind of up and down, but mostly up. And then pandemic down. People are doing less investment with, interest rates bumping up. So we're not doing as much in the deal side, but a lot of operational roles, a lot of C-suite positions we're recruiting for. We're doing a lot of comp consulting as well because people trying to figure out stocks aren't moving and how do you get to pay people appropriately and so on. Yeah, but things are good and family's good. So, no complaints. And I see your daughter joined you. Is that?
Yeah. So she wrote me a contract. This is now 10 years ago. She wrote me a contract and said, here, I've got a contract to join the firm. And I said, no. I said, I've heard about family business for years. Not really a taker of that game. And I said, and besides, I can't pay you. She was in target management training, which is great. Ran a super, they call them super centers or something, Target Superstore. And it was great. And she loved it. She just said, I can't do the retail hours. Yeah. And so she wrote a contract, came and joined us and has done an amazing job. And she and I see things about as differently as two people could. So it's interesting.
Yeah, maybe that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
I learn
a lot.
Yin yang.
I learn a lot. It is definitely yin and yang. I'm not sure who's who, but it works.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So pose the question and I'm going to take it away.
The signs of trouble as a leader in an organization, what are the telltale signs that something's broken down and there's not the kind of, you call it, buy-in that should be necessary in any institution? Doesn't matter whether I think it's business or whatever. So what are those signs?
Yeah, they're pretty common signs. And at first you don't notice them, but if you take a step back and really look, you're going to see a number of signs that are symptoms. It's stuff as simple as meetings start late or they run over or you don't get to the agenda. And that is a huge frustration for everybody. If you go into a meeting and you're on Zoom and you see people looking away or they're off camera, or if you're in person and people are working on their phones, oh, I'm just taking notes. Yeah, right. Or you see people sit back. Meetings can't be more than six people and have an effective conversation. It never works. So meetings starting late, getting canceled, running over, that's a warning sign. Another one, we're missing our objectives. We all agreed to something and then it doesn't happen. So number two, missing objectives. Number three, we're paying people more or have the best bonus plan or we're the best place to work, and yet people are leaving. It's the people we want to stay are leaving. Four, people do what we ask them to do, but they don't do any more. It's just they do just what they're asked and no mas. Another is every single person in the organization needs to be able to tell you why what we're doing matters. Every single person. We call that compelling purpose. And organizations that have game-changing results always have everybody knowing, why does it matter what we're doing? How are we changing the world? Key customers leaving or cutting back is another symptom. And finally, people unaware or confused about who's doing what. Those are all symptoms, but they all lead up to this issue of Friday nights. We're back in football season. Friday nights at your local high school football game, you see people show up with all their passion, all their enthusiasm, all their energy. What the heck is happening? Monday, when people come in and say, just tell me what you want me to do, that's the buy-in crisis that we're in today. We just do not connect into the potential of human beings. That's what really prompted me to share these stories of great leaders and how they're inspiring people to give it their all.
And Dave, you were a client back in the day. It's how we first met. And then we found some common interests beyond business and golf and so forth. But did you just learn some of this stuff through your own trials and tribulations? Or how did you get to this place where you're now an expert in helping companies get buy-in?
You know, I appreciate the label of being an expert, and that I take that with a smile, because I'm curious. I'm really curious about how do leaders overcome this challenge of complacency. And I hear people say, oh, it's this younger generation. Well, you know what? They said the same thing about every generation.
Exactly.
It's not. You learn about leadership from the people that you see lead. And that's who we learn from. Yeah, we read books and stuff, or we watch movies and see General George Patton and whatever. But we've never been shown how to get the best from people. We see a lot about inspiration. We'll go rah, rah, and we'll tell them, and we'll lead the charge. And that's all great. Nothing wrong with that. But we've never been shown how to deeply listen to people, engage them as human beings, and invite them to create the solutions. You know, we learned in school this myth. In school, we learned a couple of myths, actually. One is, there's a right answer. And two, it's the job of the teacher to tell you the right answer. Well, transfer that, fast forward it. Suddenly, we're leaders. We're supposed to have the answer and tell people the answer. As the world turns out, there are no right answers. There are lots of answers. And we get to choose which answer is right. And as a leader, you can either choose to tell people your answer, or you can ask the right questions and engage in a conversation to generate choices and come up with answers you may never have imagined that are better than yours.
So looking at just using ourselves, ethos, as an example with, quote unquote, you know, six owners or six leaders with no person at the top of an org chart that has a fancy title and makes all those decisions. I mean, how would you look at a decision-making process for a company like that? Because again, we fall into this same trap you just mentioned. It was like, well, this person should be giving me the answer. And I'm like, well, I'm not that person anymore. We got to get it from the collective. How do we engage the collective? So what would you say to a group like us?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, Keith, is what we're taught, you know, in which you hear is, you know, bring solutions, don't bring problems. Here's the problem. When you bring a solution to your partners, you know, what are we going to do about fill in the blank? You bring a solution, everybody brings their own solution, and then we debate solutions. It's a very exhausting process. The conversation that is not being had. What's that?
I said, tell me about it.
Yeah. But here's the conversation we're totally missing. We're not necessarily clear on the single problem we are trying to address right now. It's usually a cluster of problems.
Okay.
So, for example, if you have somebody who is a really problematic client and they're causing your team enormous stress, but they're profitable, what am I supposed to do about this? You've got to identify which problem you're trying to address. Is it what I do about the stress with the team, or is it about how do I deal with this client, or is it do we want this client at all? Those are three different problems with three different solutions. So first of all, be very specific. The other issues will still be there. The other problems you can deal with later, deal with the first problem and be very specific about what it is. The less obvious step that's missed all the time is we all come up with solutions that are perfect in our own minds because those solutions meet the checklist in our head for what a great solution looks like. And yet that's the conversation we never have. So before anybody shares any solution, the opportunity is for us to say, wait a minute, let's agree. How do we know what a great solution looks like? Not what a great solution is, but what does it look like? What's on the checklist in your head? And usually that will be things like, it's something that we could implement without a lot of brain damage. It's something that won't cost us a lot. It's something that we can monitor easily. It's something we can get done in 3 months. Those are all criteria for what a great solution is. And when your group gets together, decide first what a great solution looks like, and then solve together, because you're solving a single issue you've agreed to, you're using the same criteria, then apply all of your experience. And you'll come up with different solutions, but it won't be my solution or your solution or arguing stuff, because we'll be solving for the same criteria, as opposed to, hey, I've got this idea. It's a great idea. Terrific. It's a great idea to you because it meets your criteria, but we haven't talked about your criteria.
It was early on in the book, is ask your team, your organization, what would be the most impactful things we could do to change the trajectory of the company? And I loved that. And I said, I'm going to almost word for word that. And I brought it up in quote unquote our weekly meeting.
Yes.
Which is a snooze fest.
Yes.
And said, we're going to do something totally different. And I raised that. And boy, I got to say, it really made a difference. You could see people kind of perk up in their seat and go, ooh, okay, I got to think of something, but it's got to impact the business in a positive way. So that was very early on. I think you gave those kinds of questions. What did you call them? I'm trying to remember now. You know, the collective genius, or
identify the
problem.
Yeah, the collective genius is interesting because, as opposed to the teacher knows all the answers, the leaders who tap into collective genius say, all of us are smarter than any of us because we all bring different experiences to the table. And so what we want to do is to frame a specific issue, agree on criteria, and then tap into everybody's experience and basically fill the table with an overflow of ideas to choose from, where nobody has to use their ego to defend any idea. It's just all ideas. And which one can we best implement that best fits our criteria? And so that's the collective genius that leaders recognize. All of us are smarter than any of us. And the second thing is, it's important to recognize the way that half the leaders we talk to, the way their brain works is they think about stuff overnight. So if you asked me today a question, I might reflect on it overnight, and tomorrow I'd have some insight. And so if you ask me a question in a meeting and I don't have the preparation for it, I may not be able to contribute. And I'd realize, geesh, I wish I'd said. And so if it's an important decision or important discussion, make sure it happens in at least 2 different time settings so everybody can participate, or send out all the information ahead of time. Hey, I've been thinking about this. I've been thinking about client turnover. Here's the relevant data. Or I've been thinking about how much new billing we're generating. Here's the relevant data for the last 2 years. What I'm really curious to know is, and then ask your specific questions so everybody can think about that ahead of time, which is different than spitballing on the spot.
Right. Do you think that you're in a professional service firm now? You're a consultant. Yeah. So sure. Are we. Is a business like that different? Is leadership different in that environment versus we manufacture and build things and sell things?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think if you are running a business that has no people and it's just literally a factory run by robots, you could make the argument leadership doesn't matter, except that if you have suppliers and you want to have the best possible suppliers, and you have customers and you want to have customers who absolutely value what you do and they're willing to pay a premium, then leadership matters. So I can't think of a scenario where it doesn't matter.
As I said, I found that the businesses are different, but the leadership tenets aren't. I mean, you're
right.
Selling kind of an intellectual capability in consulting. You're almost selling the ability to help create solutions.
Right.
So it's not a widget. But in terms of running those businesses, I haven't seen that much different, but some people espouse that it's very different running a professional service firm versus running a manufacturing-based firm.
At the end of the day, we're in the business of providing solutions, and that's really asking the right questions and being really thoughtful listener, and then applying what you know from your experience and your skill set to a client's situation. But then you might say, oh, manufacturing's different. And I think about Charles Revson, who has the famous quote, in the factory, you know, we make perfume, in the stores, we sell hope. He knew what his product was, and it's hope. It's not perfumes.
Yeah.
Walt Disney knew his product was happiness. The amusement park is a mechanism. The movies are a mechanism. A mouse, an oversized mouse that we would catch in our house and kill, is a mechanism for child's delight in Disney's world.
Yeah, it's more of a, I guess, touching on, you know, emotional connection to things. And I get that. You also talked, and I'm going to refer to these things as we go, but
yeah,
drama-free problem-solving system. I've never seen that before, so please enlighten me and any listeners. How can you be drama-free when you're really going back and forth, it seems,
right,
with each other, as whether it's, again, whatever organization it may be.
Sure.
How's that drama-free? And so.
Yeah, great question. The drama is, my experience is, and maybe yours is different, and I'm sure others are different, but my experience is the drama is when ego is tied to a solution. So when we dissociate solutions from ego, they don't have, there's no better solution or worse solution. As I said before, they're only solutions, and our opportunity is to evaluate them. But how do we evaluate solutions? That's back to the criteria that we've all agreed to. And then it's not drama when you say, hey, you know what? I think this solution could really work for us. Not my solution, but this solution number four could work because it really meets the criteria of timeliness and ability to implement and ability to measure, or whatever our criteria is. The other thing is, so much time is wasted in that back and forth. And I was with a group of leaders in Columbus, Ohio, a group of CEOs last week, and they had a number of different ideas on how to do something for their organization, Young President's organization. And I said, I'll tell you what, we're going to use a different method. We're going to weigh the ox. And weigh the ox.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, weigh the ox is a technique that is named after a statistician in the United Kingdom in the early 1900s who lived in a town where there was a county fair. And at that county fair, they had an ox that was weighed, you know, dead ox hanging on a rope kind of thing. And he said, I wonder if people could guess the weight of the ox. You know, 800 people came in. Nobody could guess the weight of the ox. But being a statistician, he averaged all the guesses, and it was within a couple of pounds of this 1,400-pound ox. Fast forward, the U.S. Navy in the 1960s lost a submarine, and it was important to the Navy actually because of the secrets and the secret stuff on the submarine. They said, we got to find our submarine. They identified such a large area to search that the brass said, that's not going to cut it. You got to tell us where our submarine is. So they went out to 100 experts around the world and said, please help us find our sub. They went out to an expert on weather, on metal, on currents, on this and that. And they said, where's our sub? And they took the feedback and put it into algorithms and identified where the sub was within 200 yards in the North Atlantic Ocean.
Wow.
Because all of us are smarter than any of us.
It was collective wisdom of teams.
Collective wisdom.
Yeah.
So when this group in Columbus, Ohio came up with all these alternatives that met their criteria, we listed them out on the board and said, look, here are 12 different choices. Which do we think would work best? We didn't discuss. We didn't debate. There was zero conversation. What we did was said, everybody, you get votes. You get four votes. And you can place all four votes on one thing or spread out your four votes across four things. You can put two on two. I don't care. But there will be no discussion. You're going to use all of your experience and all of your insights, Keith, to place your votes. So we don't need discussion. And what you're going to find out is collectively, we're going to say number two is the one that works best for us. And so there isn't debate. There isn't, no, but you don't realize number eight is blah, blah, blah. Just place your votes. And that's where we are. And that's where we'll start. And then if we need another solution, we'll vote again. So collective genius, weighing the ox, results in drama-free solutions. We're not debating my idea. I don't have an idea. I put up an idea, which is an idea on the board that has no owner next to it. I didn't discuss it. I didn't tell you why it was best.
Yeah.
That's the other thing we love.
Would you shy away from if it's someone's idea that they become the champion of that idea, or is that fraught with trouble?
Do you mean after we select the idea?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, frankly, I would always ask that there be two champions, people who think differently. But no, I don't think that's fraught with anything. They've got passion about it. Good on them. But I would ask them to say, okay, what we'd like you to do is we'd like you to flesh out this idea and tell us how you're going to implement it and come back to the team with your plan to get team feedback so it's all of our plan. It's not your plan, because if it's your plan and you run off and implement it, then I'm going to sit here 6 months ago and say, 6 months from now, and say, hey, Keith, I never agreed to this. I didn't think it was the best idea anyway.
Right. Of course. Do you get called in leadership issues to the point where the board, an owner who's not maybe as present, just weigh in on our leadership team? Give me a thumbs up, thumbs down. Do we need to replace? Do we need to retrain? Do you get those kinds of requests? And is that, again, the wrong idea?
No, tell me a little bit more about the situation. Give me a little bit more of the scenario picture. What's the real issue?
I mean, I think of, we make most of our revenues through executive search, and it's usually strategic, high-level searches. So usually by the time we get involved, it's been identified as an issue.
Right.
The easy one is someone leaves. They're leaving. Right. We got to fill that role. Then there's all that in between. Someone's not performing. The business not performing.
Yep.
They're giving it their all, but things aren't working. By the time they come to us, a lot of that stuff is over. And I kind of wonder what happens before that. So I'm guessing that maybe organizations are hiring executive coaches. They're hiring organizational consultants, which we have done. Sure. They hire people like yourself to say, come in and maybe just measure, weigh in, tell us what we need to do here. So that's the scenario. I think we're getting it too late is all I'm saying. I don't see stuff that goes on before they hire us.
So one of the things we do before we begin working, we have a strategic practice, a leadership development practice. And what we do when we begin a practice on strategic alignment is we interview each of the executives on the senior team and we say, hey, can you tell us what the two or three most important things that the company is working on right now? 80% of the time, we'll either get different things, different wording of the things, or single words. Like, yeah, growth. Well, growth is not a strategy. Growth is a word. And the key is, are we aligned on how we're going to do that and who has to do what? And so that is usually missing. So boards that are frustrated, chairmen or owners that are frustrated with an executive, oftentimes have something different in their head than what the executive has in their head. And that's alignment.
Okay.
And so I was talking to a really talented executive today who was frustrated with a couple of his managers saying, I'm not sure they have the capability to pull it off. And he was talking about a specific thing. And I said, okay, so here's what I'd like you to do. Here's a challenge. I would like you to say to each one of them, hey, I want to be really clear on what great looks like to me and what the evidence of great is to me. And I'd like you to go away and think about how you will accomplish that and what resources you need to accomplish that. So notice it's in two conversations, but I'm going to paint you a full picture of what great looks like and what the evidence is that we've done that, and then ask you to come back and tell me how you're going to do it. By the way, when you come back, here's the critical question. Here's the sleeper question we miss. Can you tell me what you understand great to look like? And that's when you learn, does the person see great the way you do? Because usually there's a misalignment. I know you have talked to the executive as I have that's surprised when they get the call saying, you're not cutting it. They go, wait a minute. Let me tell you what I've done. 1, 2, 3. But that's not in the picture of what great looks like to the person who is saying you're not cutting it. So that conversation happened way too late. It is, tell me back what you heard great looks like. Tell me what you heard the evidence is. and how are you going to accomplish it? That's very different than saying, here's what I want you to do. Because yeah, they'll never
I gotta say, because I'm a big fan of Good to Great. I'm sure you've read it too. And
oh yeah,
it's a wonderful book. But I do think what I see sometimes missing is the how-to. They tell you, you know, they think they tell you, here's what good is and here's what great is, and you got to get the right people on the bus and in the right seats and you organize correctly. I still think there's a whole chunk missing.
But there is.
Like, how do you actually do that? And I've been thinking about writing a second book because my first book was really about why.
Uh-huh.
I know you're a fan of Simon Sinek as I am
sure.
with why. Okay. So that's a good start. Then you get into the thick of it. It's like, you know, tell me the how.
Right.
And a lot of people sink.
Yeah. So the how is calling on my experience and what we want the person who is responsible to create the how. Because if you tell them how to do it, they'll try to mimic your how and they're never going to do it successfully. You can't tell them how to do it. You can ask them how they do it. And then you can say, have you also considered if you had the criteria of A and B, how would your answer change? Because if you hear a plan and you go, well, that's not going to work, it's because it violates some criteria you have. And so you need to share the criteria, not tell them what else they should do. So alignment of the two parties is absolutely critical. And then accountability is not you being the judge, are they doing it? It's you have set up ahead of time what the evidence looks like. And then you just say, hey, is this solution cutting it or not? And the person will know. And they're the ones that ought to be doing the evaluation, not you.
Yep.
So alignment and accountability are the piece after the why, if you will. It's the how.
Again, maybe it's historical. My own experience is I grew up in a high-performance, sports-oriented family. You know, like just being second best really wasn't that great. So and maybe it was a little psychotic when your dad's a football coach and excellence is what you're after. But again, do you think that that's trouble? I've often argued with people, is perfection possible?
Yeah.
Again, I see perfection around me all the time, but a lot of people say, no, perfection is impossible to attain. Again, maybe your thoughts, how does it fit into all of this?
Yeah. It's absolutely both impossible to attain, and you can see it all the time. It depends 100% on how you define it. What is the evidence of perfection? So if I said to you, Keith, you've talked to 1,500 CEOs in your career, which ones were really great? You're going to go to the checklist in your head and go, oh, I'm looking for somebody who always hit their numbers, somebody who had people that really like to work for them, somebody who delighted customers and the board thought they walked on water and never wanted to lose them, or whatever your checklist is.
Right.
And so all I need to know is what's on the checklist in your head. And when I know that and we agree on that, then I have a chance to achieve perfection.
Got it. Maybe at the back end of the book, I was curious when I saw, what was it, chapter 12. Accelerating buy-in during recruiting, job interviews, and performance review.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of right up our alley, sort of, as professional recruiters and identifiers of leadership talent. And maybe I'll just throw it at you is, how did you learn this stuff? And what does Chapter 12 represent in your
mind? Chapter 12 represents the realization that it's not about money. Now, as a recruiter, as an executive recruiter, you get to be in the rarefied atmosphere of money is really, 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 really important. Did I tell you how important money is? You know, because you're going to say, okay, so if my compensation is tied to the pay, what's the total pay on this job? And the board's going to say, how much are we willing to pay? And the executive that you're talking to is going to go, how much am I going to make? And so everybody's talking about money. So obviously it's about money. Here's the truth. It's not about money. And the more that the leader realizes it's really not about money, that's a myth. That's the money myth, the better they'll do. The reason I say that, quick story. A CEO of a company, fast-growing technology company, really successful, called a town hall meeting for the next day, and people were kind of alarmed. What's the matter? Are we being sold? Did we do something wrong? What's going on?
Something's up.
And he said, hey, I just want to let you know, we just passed $1 billion in revenue, which was a big deal to the top four shareholders of the company. But to the average person, it didn't mean anything. And so when I say it's not about money myth, here's how the money myth happens. When people leave our company and turnover is hugely expensive to a company, whether it's executive level or frontline level, it's hugely expensive because of the retraining, the wasted opportunity, the months it takes for somebody to spool up, the time spent interviewing, incredibly expensive. But turnover occurs because we're not meeting people's needs. But when somebody leaves, the great lie, as it was explained to me by the vice chairman of a Wall Street bank, is I left for a better job. Code words for I left because you're not meeting my needs, you didn't listen, or you people are jerks. Think about it. Gallup would tell you it takes at least 25% higher pay for people who are fully bought in, 25% more before they'll leave. Most job offers, not necessarily at CEO ranks, but most job offers in the rest of the world are for less than 25%, and some people will take pay cuts. So it's not about money. That's a money myth, but it's reinforced. Every time somebody says, I left for a better job, what we hear as executives, we hear, oh, they left for more money. They might not have left for more money. Don't kid yourself. Yeah. Three things people are looking for in their work. Three things. And this has been amplified and aggravated by COVID, where people had a lot of time to think about the meaning of life and the meaning of work, and accelerated by a new generation. Here are the three things that matter. One is we have a clear answer as an organization, as a team, to why bother doing this. We have a compelling purpose. It's never about money. Tell me why it's worth doing. You know, Walt Disney creating happiness. Sam Walton putting money back in people's pockets. Really clearly identified reasons why it's worth doing. So everybody has to understand that. And that compelling purpose and your company values are part of what you ask in the interview process, part of what you refer to when you make decisions, and part of what you do when you give people promotions. So compelling purpose is one of the three things that's more important than money. Two is your voice being heard, meaning you don't need everybody to make every decision, but if there's a decision that affects somebody's work, then they should have a say or at least be heard, their opinion heard in how it plays out or how it might play out or what to consider. And so voice being heard is the second most important thing. I shouldn't say most important thing. It's two of three important things. And the third is they're seen as a human being, not a human doing. And so when people are seen as human beings, when their voice is heard, and when they know they're doing something greater than themselves together, it is more powerful than money and will cause people to stay in an organization.
Can we use that bit? They're not a human doing, they're a human being. I like that. That's catchy.
Absolutely. You got to have three out of three if you want people to stay. Now, how's that come into interviewing? Share with people your compelling purpose. Hey, you know what we're about? We're really about creating opportunities for people in need or whatever it is. And ask them, how do you see yourself in that? And if you have a value, say a value is integrity, ask about that value. In the interview process, don't say, do you have integrity?
Of course, everyone says yes. The old self-starter. Are you a self-starter? No one's ever said no to me. I stopped asking that question early on.
Can you tell me about a time in the workplace where your integrity has been challenged and how did you handle it? What you'll learn about is how they relate to integrity. So use values and compelling purpose in the interview process. And then when you want to commend somebody for something they did, always tie it to purpose or values. When you do a success story and share it with the company, hey, I want you to know Mary did the following thing, which really speaks to our value of integrity or whatever it is, hard work. Those things being values, compelling purpose, are part and parcel of hiring, of motivating, retaining, and of rewarding.
Just a couple other quick ones before I let you go. Do you believe in tough love leadership style?
Describe what you mean by tough love. How would that play out?
Right? You're going to consult on me right here. I found, having, as you said, interviewed a lot of CEOs and leaders over the years, I've heard that phrase more than a few times. And what I think that they mean is that they're hard on their people. They're tough. They have very high standards. They don't praise people a lot. They're paid those very, very high standards. And they're coaching those people up for the realities that the marketplace is a tough place. And I'm going to toughen you up because that's part of what I think you need to do to be a successful leader at some point in the future. So those are like the general criterions I'm thinking that I hear from people.
Yeah. So if that means I'm going to consistently apply our norms and what we have defined as our compelling purpose and values, I'm going to consistently apply what it is we agreed you're to do. And if we consistently apply how you perform against the measures we've agreed to, then I would say, yes, those are traits of a good leader. A great leader, if you define tough love as we don't hand out praise, we give you the money if you do it right. To me, that's short-sighted. And what you will do is really limit the workforce that's available to you because that reputation will be well known. And it's not that I want you to just send me a certificate for showing up, but when I bust my ass and I do something above and beyond, I'd at least like it to be seen. It doesn't mean you need to fawn over me, but if it's recognized, maybe not by the CEO, but if it's recognized by the organization, that goes an awfully long way.
Yeah, fair enough. You don't have to answer this one, but I'm curious with famous people in news these days. I knew Trump when he was a hotel operator and had fair interaction with him and his family and placed a CEO for his hotel company. Elon Musk is probably one of the more successful businessmen of our generation, yet there'd be a lot of spirited debate on how both of those people are as leaders.
Yeah.
I'm just curious if you'd be willing to just kind of give your take on both, either.
Yeah.
Are they unfairly judged? And I'm talking purely about leadership skills and style, not political leanings.
We have done a lot of research and asking about what makes game-changing organizations, as I know you have. And we found that there are three elements 100% of the time. Those three elements are the compelling purpose I talked about, a clear understanding by everybody of why it's worth doing, aligned actions, meaning horizontally across the organization, we're all pulling in the same way to get something important done. We all have very clear measures and very few priorities. Okay. And great things, by the way, generally take 4 to 6 quarters to get done if you're really fast. And the third is empowered people. People who know what the rules are, know why it matters, and they don't have to go say, "Mother, may I?" They're empowered to go out and get stuff done. So if you look at those three measures, a really quick analysis, and I don't know either individual, but a really quick analysis would show you that Elon Musk excels in terms of compelling purposes. So saying, "I'm going to build a colony on Mars," and everything he does lines up to that. What are all the 200 pieces we need to get right to get people in a colony on Mars? And I want it done in my lifetime. That's inspiring because it's greater than any single person. And it's not about the $1 trillion pay package to him. It's about, let's do something greater. When it comes to empowering people, one of the issues with mercurial leaders, which I believe each of them are, is that you go through a lot of different people. You get short-term afterburner burnout, and that creates a lot of instability in the organization. The practical implication of that is it's like, oh yeah, here comes another leader. They'll be gone in 6 months because they'll get fired. And so to me, that's leadership that doesn't tap into the potential of all the people, because people just become immune to the leader and go, yeah, whatever. There'll be another president here. And, you know, let's see, what time is it? By 2:30, there'll be another leader. And then having horizontal alignment, aligned actions, requires input from everybody's experience. And my observation is those two leaders may not treasure other people's experience as much as they do their own. So while they have the strong ego and great communication skills to push compelling purpose, I think they're leaving money on the table when it comes to empowering people and aligning actions. But I could be totally wrong, but I would not put them in the Leadership Hall of Fame.
I've thought about this, again, a great deal, because does success in some way automatically make you great? I mean, Steve Jobs went through this too, right? There are plenty of people that said Steve Jobs is a horrible leader. And
absolutely a horrible leader.
And yet, my goodness, he's affected in a positive way most of the planet.
And is that in spite of himself, in spite of his leadership, or because of his leadership? But he had the singular vision, he had compelling purpose, and he had the drive to cause people to get things done. But what I'd point out is, since he left, one of the marks of a leader is what you leave behind. And since he has left this earth, the company has been on what I would argue is a slow decline, not for lack of effort, but for lack of the foundation of the processes that create great.
Got it. Well, certainly, I don't want to leave on a negative note, but I think it is what it is, right? Leadership is one of those things that's just not easy to define. That's why leadership books keep coming out. It's one of the most hotly debated subjects in the business world, if not every walk of life. And it's one of the great things that makes people people.
And Keith, what I would argue is that the area which has received the least attention and has the fewest tools is that empowered people segment. And my belief and our belief is all of us are smarter than any of us, that collectively we get a lot more done than if we're doing it individually. And what's missing in most organizations is an alignment and an agreement about what our priorities are, not what are the 12 things. It's what are the three things? One of the rules we have in the book is 3 is greater than 7, which means we've had the tough conversations to say no to most stuff. And we're just focused on these three things. Come hell or high water, we're going to get these three things done. And all of us view the world differently based on our experiences. So I would challenge everybody listening to go take the self-assessment on your organization's buy-in. And in your case, Keith, have each of your partners take the team assessment. And it's free. It's online. It's buyinbook.com. Go take the assessment and then get together and compare your notes and say, wow, I had a really different take on that. And you learn from people's different take because you have your blind spots. They have your blind spots. They don't have your experience. You don't have their experience. So take the assessment at buyinbook.com, then compare notes, then decide where we're going to start. Oh, wow. If we just made our meetings better. Oh, wow. If we just fill in the blank. I don't think we need any more afternoon schnoozers. You got plenty of meetings to attend.
True enough. Consider it done. We will be doing that. I hope a lot more of our clients will be doing that, but we'll be pushing your book because I really enjoyed it and thought it really synthesized what leaders should be doing and gives them a roadmap that a lot of times weren't there before. As you said, you didn't learn it in college and you learned it sort of through osmosis, but you picked, you know, a few things here and a few things there.
Keith, I so wish I had this 20 years ago as a leader. I wish I had half of these techniques, and it's all about how do I unlock potential? How do I unlock potential in my team and achieve something greater than anybody thought could be achieved? That's what it's all about. That's what winning looks like. Even your dad would be proud.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you for joining Dollars and Drivers. Until next time, it's Keith Kefchin signing off.